going to introduce Seema here as our speaker. And we talked a little bit about Mike Schramm's from our partners in Cleveland. Seema's from our partners in Baltimore. We're part of the National Neighborhood Indicator Partnership out of the Urban Institute. And NNIP is just a wonderful group of folks who spend lots of time talking about data. It's about as big as this group. And we're going to be having our conference. The next conference is in Denver in the fall, and following that, we're going to be sponsoring the conference here in the spring of 2015. So I know a lot of you might be interested in some of the things that NNIP is doing, and how we find so many wonderful things going on in the country, and going on in data of like partners, because a lot of it's through NNIP. And Seema Iyer is the Associate Director of the Jacob France Institute at the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance at the University of Baltimore. She is also somebody, which is at the Merrick School of Business, and I forgot about that part. She oversees the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance since 2011. She serves on several community-oriented boards, including the Baltimore City Head Start and the Baltimore Community Foundation's Neighborhoods Committee. In 2010, which was recognized in 2010 as one of Maryland's leading women by the Daily Record. She is co-chair and teaches at the University of Baltimore's Real Estate and Economic Development Program. And prior to joining the University of Baltimore, Seema served as Chief of Research and Strategic Planning for Baltimore City Planning Department and was responsible for data and policy analysis, geographic information system services, and population forecasting. She also has been a big voice in Baltimore through various editorials and other reports and papers that have been extremely well received in the community. So again, for folks that are looking for data-driven decision making, Seema is going to give you a very powerful and really interesting presentation of what they've been doing and what she's been doing in Baltimore. She spearheaded the city's 2010 Census Complete Count campaign, as well as other planning processes, including the 2009 Food Policy Task Force and 2008 Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy. We've got a couple of SPC, our Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission, our MPO here, so they'll be talking about this with you later. She holds a PhD in Urban and Regional Planning from the University of Michigan, specializing in comprehensive and strategic planning for community development. She has an MA in Regional Science, along with me, one of the few people left, from the University of Pennsylvania. It's always happy to have a regional scientist here, and we're really proud of that. And a BA in Mathematics and Russian Studies from the University of Pennsylvania. Seema, welcome to
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Good to see you.
What an honor and pleasure to be here this afternoon. Seema has had my admiration for a long time. She actually helped me a little bit while I was working on my dissertation a long time ago, so I owe her many times over. So this is going to be a hopefully interactive session. Feel free to interrupt me at any time, but I did want to go through a pretty comprehensive look at how we use the indicators in Baltimore that I now have the privilege to oversee this project, but it's been going on since 2000. So a long-term indicator project that we're now reaping the benefits of, that kind of continuous monitoring of neighborhoods. And now we can kind of see what the value of doing something like this. So just so we have a common understanding of what community-based indicators are, I'm gonna give you a little bit of literature review, since hopefully some of you and students need to know this. They're bits of information that when you compile them together reflect the profile of a place. It's exactly like when you go to the doctor's office and you get your own vital signs. No one of those measures is you, and not even the compilation of it is you, but it's a reflection of your physiology, and that's the same way you can think of these community-based indicators. And that's what I tell communities when we go there. The data itself is a reflection of you, but you can change these data. It's not the end-all, be-all. But they're useful to provide insight for the direction that your neighborhood is going in. Also, even though we can argue about actual numbers, we do try to tell people that it's more important to look at the relativity of those numbers in relation to other places and the directionality of those numbers. And of course, the community-based indicators is what's most exciting to me, and hopefully all of you that are involved in this type of work, is that it's truly community-driven. Community members of all walks, people that think that they're not data-driven, they know what a crime rate is. They know chronic absenteeism. Every time I go into a community, everybody knows what these numbers actually mean to them on the ground and what it means to their places. So it's very community driven, and we at the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance actually specifically try and make sure our indicators are community led. Also kind of important to think about the scale at which we're doing these indicators. You know, it's not the city, it's not the region, it's called the neighborhood, and it's a neighborhood for a reason. Baltimore, which I'm sure Pittsburgh is pretty similar, is a city of neighborhoods. We're not a city of zip codes, which is different. In many surrounding counties, they think of themselves as zip codes. We are not a city of zip codes, we're a city of neighborhoods. And I think that's very true of many urban areas around the country. And these places have these durable properties, which is what Robert Sampson talks about in his work. And you can see why they're durable. It's because people in them are trying to maintain those places, right? Make them stable, make sure that they survive into the future. And so just like when I talked about you getting your vital signs, your biometrics when you go to the doctor's office, these indicators are meant to serve as ecometrics, the ecometrics of places. And that's how I look at these data, and that's how when we go out in the communities, we talk about it. And those ecometrics really are aimed to reflect the complexity of even small-ish places like a neighborhood, the economy, the environment, and the social processes going on in neighborhoods. And these neighborhoods truly are organisms. I'm preaching to the choir, hopefully, on that. But all of these things interplay in that tiny space called a neighborhood. And the point of this type of continuous monitoring, yet another literature for those of you that may not be familiar, this is the collective impact from Kramer, the Stanford Social Innovation Review. Why are we doing this? It's because we're part of a broader collective impact, hopefully. And the five elements of that are having that common agenda, the shared measurement system, which is the role that we play in making sure that a broad and diverse set of stakeholders are actually looking at the same data and reflecting on whether or not their programs are effective. The mutually reinforcing activities, you know the people in your town that are doing this, that their activities are complementary to each other, even if they may not necessarily be the same organization. But they are continuously communicating with each other, and of course we have great foundations, obviously here in Pittsburgh and in Baltimore, supporting that work on an ongoing basis. The National Neighborhood Indicators Partnership, which Sabina mentioned, and obviously you are probably well aware of, we were one of the early adopters to that network. I don't know when you joined, but the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance joined in 2008. All right, 2008. So we won on that one. We're 8 years ahead of you guys. But you guys are lightning ahead of us in other things. That's right. We started, I think Baltimore started as an early adopter. Baltimore itself is a pretty early adopter in data innovation. We're the first city in the country to start a 311 system, and we're the first city in the country to adopt that 311 system to be used in the city stat process for effective public management. So Baltimore has a little bit of a history of data innovation, so the fact that we were part of the NNIP as one of the early adopters is also not a surprise. But again, the point is that you have to sustain a project like this and sustain it so that you start reaping the benefits over the long term. So these are our, we call them communities. These are community statistical areas in the city of Baltimore. I'm going to talk a minute about boundaries because no neighborhood likes boundaries. Nobody likes anybody's boundaries. These are what we call communities, and they are aggregations of census tracts. So they don't actually reflect what a neighborhood will call a neighborhood. The city planning department, which, as Sabina just mentioned, happened to be the place that I oversaw, has a dedicated neighborhood map, which is 270 of these. This is only 55 communities, so they're aggregations of neighborhoods. And then behind all of that are the census tracts themselves. And there's roughly 400 to 500 census tracts. So you have various levels of scales. And when the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance was created, they decided to go to this scale, this 55-level scale. And again, thinking about scale, sometimes when you zoom in too close to a phenomenon, you can't actually see the phenomenon, right? And I think the city of Baltimore has gotten used to these boundaries now. I will say every time I go anywhere, nobody likes a boundary. But now that it's been in existence for 14 years, people have started to get used to it and see the value of that scale. Whatever type of work you're doing in, even if you fix a block, that block isn't sitting in a context, right? And this gives you those contexts. The city health department has adopted these boundaries in their community health profiles. They started doing that in 2008. Our planning, our state planning department has adopted these boundaries in their profiles for the city of Baltimore as well. So I think it was a tough sell in the beginning because nobody, again, liked these boundaries. But I'm going to come back to these boundaries because at this scale, I think our indicators are actually showing patterns that might not have revealed itself if you just stick to the census tract, which is a little bit too pixelated for the type of work that we have ended up doing. And this was not, you know, by design. This is just what happened in Baltimore. The other thing I will say is that every single one of these haphazard boundaries has a name, right? It's not, I live in tract 1205. Which nobody knows. I don't know what census tract I live in. And if you do know what census tract you live in, you deserve to be here. but most people don't know what census tract they live in. And so when you talk about census tracts in that way, it doesn't really resonate. But if I can say, using the data that we have, that in Station North, the crime rate is whatever, everybody who lives in Station North would at least listen to me, right? They might not believe me, they might not agree with me, but we can have a conversation because I put the name to the indicator, the name of the place to the indicator. And that's what I think has been so powerful about having these communities in place where the indicators are going. So let's talk about how we started using this. The city of Baltimore, unfortunately, has suffered 60 years of population decline, and I just looked up Pittsburgh last night, and it seems that we share the 2000 to 2010 population decline. We also lost about 30,000 people between 2000 and 2010, which is just the last decade. But unlike Pittsburgh, Baltimore seems to have very little excuse for this kind of population decline. You know, we're sitting in the middle of the Washington-Boston corridor, right on the water. What is going on with us that we could yet again lose population when Philadelphia gained population, Newark, New Jersey gained population, and Baltimore did not? And I will say that I think it was a bit of a shock to Baltimoreans that we yet again lost that kind of population. So we used the indicators to try and figure out what's going on. Because if you just looked in the paper, what are you going to see? Nobody wants to live in the city because of bad crime and bad education. Well, if you think about what the crime rate had gone down, all of our indicators are showing that the crime rate is going down. So why, that's not necessarily the problem. And actually our education indicators had been going up. So we had evidence to kind of combat this myth about crime and education. That's not to say that we don't have issues, all urban areas have issues, but Baltimore actually was trying to fix it. So in terms of population growth, we couldn't use that as an excuse anymore. But clearly something else was going on because we lost 30,000 people again. So again, this is a little bit of a shock. I don't know if anybody been to Baltimore, recently. The 2000s seemed like a turnaround decade, right? The Inner Harbor had been pretty mature, which is right around the water. Tons of housing units had been developing around the water. Lots of construction. The Hope 6 projects had come down. We had six towers coming down, and in its place, these mixed-income communities. Crime rate was coming down. So it seemed like there was activity. There was people moving back. So what was it about these? So we took a look at our data, and in fact, 35% of those 55 neighborhoods that you saw, or communities that you saw, did in fact grow. So what can we learn from them and look at the indicators and actually learn from the fact that some of our neighborhoods are in fact growing? Let's celebrate that as a success and figure out what's going on. So this ended up being that pattern. And you'll notice that if we did this at the census tract level, we would have lots of little dots. But when we do it at this level, there's a pretty clear pattern. Something is going on the west side of Baltimore, where it is nothing is growing back there if we look at it at this kind of scale. So what's going on in West Baltimore? and most of the city of West Baltimore. And then you do see the growth around the water, which we know we see. And then I'll show you what's going on in the north and the northeast as I walk through this presentation. So first of all, let's dispel some myths about crime. So the pattern is here on the left-hand side. You can keep seeing that pattern as I show you some of the indicator maps. And remember, when you're looking at indicator maps, when for our maps, a darker color means the higher value. That doesn't necessarily mean good or bad. Higher value, we allow communities to judge if that's a good or a bad thing. In this case, I think we can probably all agree the higher value of crime rate is probably a bad thing. But if you notice, it's not the same pattern as the neighborhoods that grew. And in fact, doing just some simple group testing, the crime rate in the growing, these are called CSAs for community statistical areas, in the growing CSAs was 82 per 1,000, and in the declining one was 63 per 1,000. We had less crime in the declining neighborhoods, and we could prove it using the data that we had. From planning literature, from all the research, we know crime happens where there's people. Crime doesn't happen in the middle of the highway where nobody's there. Crime happens where there's people, and so guess what? If you have a growing, thriving neighborhood, you're gonna get more crime. And that's certainly not a deterrent. It's not a deterrent to growth. Crime is a problem, but it's not a deterrent to growth. So we can start to kind of, you know, combat some of those myths. We get school record data from the school system, and we can track fifth grade level reading. And there is very little difference. There's a little bit of a difference. The growing CSAs, fifth graders, 80% of them scored proficient. But for the declining ones, it was 76. So there is a little bit of a, there's not too much of a difference between growing and declining. So education is on the rise. We've still got an issue, but it can't be the reason why people are just not moving to the city. Diversity index. This is something clearly we as a city need to address. Where we have growing neighborhoods, we had by far more diverse neighborhoods. More diverse across what we're calling the four, not the two, categories of race and ethnicity. Black and white in the city of Baltimore, we've got lots of segregation issues historically, but also Hispanic and Asian. And where all four of them are coming together, we have a lot of growth. And again, the data allows us to make kind of a data-driven claim on that. So what is our problem? We get great diversity when we have, so diversity is an asset, crime doesn't seem to be a deterrent to growth, and education is on the fence, doesn't seem to be the reason, and there's no aha moment for education at that neighborhood scale. So in terms of what regional equity is gonna look like in the 21st century, for those that are interested, Manuel Pastor, lots of folks at USC are writing about the fact that it's not that every neighborhood is going to have every amenity. It's that everybody in every neighborhood should have access to your entire region's amenities, right? Eventually, everybody in any neighborhood is gonna have to go to the airport. You're not gonna have 55 airports, you're gonna have one airport. So you have to have easy access to things like the airport, to things like retail, which is now more outside the city than inside the city. Access to jobs, which is everywhere in the region, not just in your central core. So it's more about enabling anybody from any neighborhood to be able to get to other neighborhoods. That's the key to 21st century equity, according to a lot of the planner literature. So let's talk about networks. Again, if you've been to Baltimore, you've probably driven on one of these. I just drove on one of these this morning. The red lines are our interstate highway system. Every single one of the neighborhoods I grew is on one of those red lines. What does that mean? If you live in the city of Baltimore, you need to have a car. We don't really have too much of a transit system. The black line is our transit system, so it goes north and south. Sadly, it goes right along our highway, so you have double accessibility if you're living in that north side. And it's absolutely true. If you live in the city of Baltimore, you still need to get to the airport, which is down south. You still need to get to job centers, which are outside of the city now. And so if you have to have a car, you're gonna be living pretty close to an interchange, so you can get out. And the neighborhoods that grew are right along those lines. So accessibility is a key function of neighborhood growth into the future. And you could probably think in Pittsburgh, those places that are accessible are probably growing. And this happened to us when we were in St. Louis for the conference. It's happening in St. Louis too, where they have accessibility as the neighborhoods that are growing. This is only, of course, one type of accessibility. This is a physical accessibility, but you can start thinking about the social accessibility and environmental accessibility as well. So let's take a look at the data. Growing and declining CSAs, the number of people that are taking transit is pretty similar. People that take transit either do it by choice, because they live close and they are living in a walkable neighborhood, or a place where they choose not to have a car, and we have more rising kind of populations that are choosing not to have a car, or unfortunately, they don't have a choice, and they have to use public transit because they can't afford a car. And we've got the whole spectrum in Baltimore City. But if you just look at the average of transit use, there's not much difference between growing and declining. But if you look at travel time, a huge difference. And this is, again, looking at the growing versus the declining. In growing CSAs, only 15.8% of the population travels more than 45 minutes. 45 minutes is a threshold, even nationally, with respect to the research, that if you drive or commute more than 45 minutes, you're apparently a very unhappy person. But if you stick below the 45 minutes, you'll be fine and happy and dandy. And that's showing up in those neighborhoods where you have low commute times, those neighborhoods are growing. And look at the difference between the declining ones. Huge difference in commute times. And even if you look at the pattern, again, that west side, there was no highway, there was no transit. And again, if you are familiar with the city of Baltimore, we have a ring around the city. And so these neighborhoods used to be the way you get out of town. From downtown, you would go up Liberty Road or out 40, but now you just go around. And now these neighborhoods are on the way to nowhere, because nobody has to drive through them anymore. And we can see that in the way that indicators are shaping up here. Networks is a big problem in urban areas in the 21st century, but also, obviously, infrastructure. We have an aging infrastructure. We happen to have a pretty good water system, but that water system is crumbling. We have lots of other aging. I'm going to talk very specifically about the housing aging infrastructure. The 330,000 people that left the city of Baltimore did not take their homes with them, so those homes are still sitting there and increasingly becoming vacant and abandoned. So right around the growing neighborhoods, which are in the blue, we see the hash marks for high rates of vacant and abandoned housing. So you can see that the places that were not growing have these high rates of vacant and abandoned housing. But I did want to also point out on the west side, it doesn't seem like it's high rates of vacant and abandoned housing either, and it's still not growing. So we're going to do a little bit more investigation. But huge difference between growing and declining CSAs with respect to vacant and abandoned housing. If you lived in a growing CSA, on average, you had 1.6% vacant and abandoned housing. One or two houses out of 100. That's how low the threshold is for people wanting to move into a neighborhood with vacant and abandoned housing. Declining housing, it's 10, 11% at least. And so it's kind of, we figured out that there's a little bit of a tipping point. Once your neighborhood crosses over 4%, we saw in all of our indicators that at that scale, at 4%, your neighborhood started to spiral out of control. And so we've given, in terms of some of the policy that you use these indicators for, we've given the city those 5, 6% neighborhoods where you have a shot of bringing them down below 4. 4 doesn't make it, it makes it a necessary condition, but it doesn't make it a sufficient condition. We see those neighborhoods that are below 4 but still didn't grow, but at least you have to have below 4%. We don't know what it is about 4%, 4 out of 100 homes. Something out of that, if you drive down a block or something like that, people are turning away from those types of neighborhoods, which you can imagine makes sense. We don't know why that's happening, but the indicators are showing that there is a little bit of a tipping point. And we can think about Pittsburgh neighborhoods where it probably has similar attributes. So growing neighborhoods didn't have much to do with crime or education. It had to do with vacant and abandoned housing and lack of access to jobs. I'm going to come back to jobs in a minute. And hopefully this either resonates with you in Pittsburgh, or if it doesn't, maybe you know something I don't know about how neighborhoods work. So we put out a compendium of these indicators every year. We're on our 12th edition. It just came out last year. And Sabina and I are going to be on a panel that we just learned about in September. but that the compendium alone is irrelevant, right? It's how you use that compendium, or who uses it, or who you can get in front of. Because that compendium of information, we just put out 8,000 data points. That's too much information even for us. So you have to discreetly and appropriately address specific indicators at the right time to the right people so that it becomes actionable. So these next set of slides, I'm going to talk about a little bit about what we learned and how we try to do that, how to try to make that actionable. So with our 12th edition, we did find that the housing market in Baltimore City has finally rebounded. The sales price had been going down continuously since 2006, and it's just on its way back. We see increase in rehabilitation permits, so we know people are coming back to start investing. We see new construction permits, which in the city of Baltimore is pretty unusual to have new construction. And so we're seeing more of that. We're also seeing less cash-based and less foreclosure-based sales. And these are the types of indicators that we track, and we've been tracking over the last 10 years. But in 2011, we tried to revamp our indicators. We actually had a community-based outreach process where we talked to community members about what they'd like to see. Cash-based sales and foreclosure-based sales were two of the new ones that we just started tracking in 2011. But then, again, point of getting your profile from the doctor, you're looking from everything to stay in range, and when something's out of range, that's what you address, right? If you have high blood pressure, everything else is hopefully okay, but you're trying to address your blood pressure. They're all related, but you can at least get that thing back in range. And so we see that there is foreclosure filing increase that doesn't necessarily lead to a foreclosure, but that is an indication of a home under stress. And if you can get to them fast enough to keep them in their home, we have actually a whole coalition on homeownership preservation that we provide this type of information to. And unfortunately, we see an increase in vacant and abandoned housing. The city of Baltimore has a program called Vacants to Value, which is strategic, not only strategic demolition, but strategic code enforcement and strategic acquisition of properties, which I'll talk a little bit about as we walk through. But the fact that we're seeing an increase in vacant and abandoned housing is certainly not a good sign for the city, because I just showed you how important that is for us in terms of growth. Chronic absenteeism is a big issue for most of our distressed neighborhoods, but then obviously for the city in general. If you're not going to school, it's probably impossible for you to eventually graduate, which is what we're aiming for. But this is something that Binya and the city have been tracking since 2000. And we can see that for elementary in particular, which was a little bit of a juggernaut, it was higher than middle school came down, which is amazing in the city of Baltimore. Most of the schools went from K to 5 to a dedicated middle to K to 8. And when that change happened, we could see that chronic absenteeism at the middle school levels went in half, which is fantastic, because I think kids were starting to stay in school because it was a stable environment, because it was the same school for 9 years. All the teachers had known them, you know, since they were in kindergarten. So middle school seems to be in a good place, but elementary was pretty high. And they're attributing it a little bit to parents not thinking that it's that important for first kindergarten kids to go to school. But with a major campaign, including at the mayor's office, we see that it's coming down. We also track kindergarten readiness. Maryland is one of those states that likes to track their students well before No Child Left Behind. So we do have this kindergarten readiness scores, which in the month of October, when kids come into kindergarten, they get assessed on whether or not they were ready to begin with. So the first 5 years of their life, did they prepare them for kindergarten? And so we started tracking that last year for the first time at the neighborhood level. It's been being tracked at the city level, but at the neighborhood level, and we can see that more neighborhoods have greater kindergarten readiness because we're, as a city, focusing on it. And you can see which neighborhoods are growing. The city of Baltimore did attract a lot of 18 to 34-year-olds in that 2000 and 2010. Those neighborhoods that grew were predominantly younger people. So millennials, what do they want? You know, maybe you've already heard this before, but millennials want BMWs. You heard this? And it's not the car. They don't want the car or the BMW. They want biking, mass transit, and walkability. And that's what they're looking for in terms of urban amenities in their neighborhoods. So in terms of, again, looking at the indicators as the structural issue of neighborhoods that allow growth, if your neighborhood doesn't have any bike lanes, you're not necessarily going to attract millennials, right? If we know that this is what millennials are looking for, and we know that the city in general is looking. So we gave the 7 bike lanes. This is actually a new indicator for us this year. We gave the 7 communities and actually reached out to them and said, you don't have any bike lanes. You are at an impediment if you wanted to try and attract millennials. And this is something very actionable, right? The city has a bike master plan. They're going through streetscaping on every neighborhood. You can communicate with your city council person or with your Department of Transportation to say, when are the bike lanes coming to my neighborhood and what do we have to do to prepare? And those are the types of things that communities get engaged in. So, again, the point of the indicators are trying to support neighborhood level work. In terms of resilience, we can call it sustainability, we can call it resilience. This definition comes from the urban, the UN, the United Nations definition on community resilience. It's the ability of communities to use whatever resources they have. We know that every neighborhood doesn't have the same level of resources, but use those resources to get through adverse situations. And again, every neighborhood has a different criteria of what they're considering adverse situations. Our most distressed communities are dealing with totally different things than some of our more affluent ones, but they're still dealing with aging infrastructure and sewer, basement sewer backups. So adverse conditions is certainly relative, but the ability of a community to actually get through those adverse conditions is hopefully what the community indicators can help us see. I work a lot in communities during their small area master planning process because the data becomes a source of how they want to try and affect change in their neighborhood during the planning process. And I've been in Baltimore now for 10 years, and every single neighborhood planning process that I've gone into, no matter what the topic, if it's housing, if it's public health, if it's crime, the biggest issue is I need access to a job. And especially during the recession, that's what everyone has said. So unfortunately, the indicators show that high unemployment is highly correlated with so many other negative indicators. High unemployment, low median income, that makes hopefully some sense, but low life expectancy. Maybe not as clear a connection, but it's very clear in the data that we have. The high commute times are a big barrier for employment, which we see. If you can't get to your job on time every day, likelihood of you remaining employed is pretty slow. It's pretty slim. We do track high rates of dirty streets and alleys. We track the 311 calls. And these are neighborhoods that are unfortunately have a lot of physical disorder and then eventually high crime. It's less number of incidents in those neighborhoods, but the type of incidents end up being more violent. So accessibility. Let me just show you, this is a map of unemployment rate, and you can see kind of in the middle of the town, the highest places of high unemployment. And if you just keep your eyes on that, every other indicator that I'll show you will be similarly negative. High unemployment, very highly correlated with high travel times. You can see the two areas in the middle still have high travel times. Again, this is the map of accessibility. Low life expectancy. So in this case, you want it to be high. And unfortunately, those areas in the middle have very low life expectancy. And the range for life expectancy, I don't know if you guys have done this here, but it's a 20-year swing in terms of life expectancy by neighborhood. The average is 73.9, but it swings from 65 in one of our lowest neighborhoods to 84.4. And we're talking about neighborhoods that are within a mile of each other. And they might as well be on two different sides of the planet. And we're doing a little bit more research to show that it is this access to employment that's really the driver of that kind of disparity in the city. Again, the city of Baltimore had been an early adopter of 311 calls, so we have very low uptake in the beginning when people were still trying to figure out what 311 system. Do you guys have a 311 system? Yeah. What the 311 system was, will anybody actually respond if you call? So we have pretty low rates at the beginning of the last decade, and then it kind of ramps up and we're plateaued there, but you can see where in the city we have more people calling for dirty streets and alleys, and it's the same neighborhoods that have those high unemployment rates. So just kind of a lack of concern for the neighborhood because of the lack of kind of prospects of the future. All right, so how do we use the indicators? This is all fine and dandy that I can kind of talk about the citywide issues and these, but in the end, communities want to know what's going on in my neighborhood, right? So we have a campaign All we have of those 55 communities, I said there were 270 registered neighborhoods with the city, but there's 690 community organizations that claim that space. I don't know if that's true here in Pittsburgh too, but we have lots of community organizations. So we tell them when the vital signs indicators come out, well, every single one of your communities has a profile of all 100 indicators that are there for your community. Take a look at that profile and have a conversation about it. Something simple that you can do at your agenda meeting for the next time your community organization is going to have a meeting. So we have this kind of what's in your profile campaign that we're doing right now. And one of the things that, you know, as you put it on the agenda and have a conversation about it, the key is to set a goal, right? If you're a 5% vacant and abandoned housing community, you want to set that goal to come below 4%. And you know exactly how many houses that is. If you've got 1,000 houses, you need to bring that down by 10 houses in the next year. So what is your community, which 10 houses do you want to do? Which 10 houses do you want your community kind of engage in? So that's the level of concrete kind of data analysis that we're able to give a community that's easy math, nothing terribly complicated, percentages and counts. And that kind of, I think, aha moment when we go into communities that we're talking about 10 homes. You need to work with the city's housing department on the vacancy to values program and figure out which 10 homes are going to bring back or demolish or do whatever your community wants to do as you're doing through this planning process. And then, of course, engage with us on Facebook and Twitter. And then we also have a day-to-day, which we do in July, largely because that's the time that we have to do it. But shockingly, we get 200 people coming to talk about data in the middle of the summer. I don't know, maybe it's because you guys can come down. Maybe it's because it's air-conditioned in the middle of the summer that people come in to talk about data. But it's amazing. So again, this is not surprising that people want to have a conversation about what the data is actually meaning about for neighborhoods. So let me tell you a story. Remember in that map where it wasn't growing, it didn't have high rates of vacant and abandoned housing, at least according to the official record, but it was still not growing. What's going on out there? This was Howard Park, West Arlington. If you go on our website, actually, you could actually go on there right now. It's called bniajfi.org. You can click on a map, and you can get all of your community-based indicators. So the orange one is the Howard Park, West Arlington. It's one of those neighborhoods that doesn't look like it's got a lot of vacant and abandoned housing, and yet it didn't grow, and it's on that west side that's kind of inaccessible a little bit. So what's going on there? 2% vacant and abandoned housing in 2011, but so vacant and abandoned housing in the city of Baltimore and probably here as well is a code enforcement designation, right? The housing department has gone out and actually designated that property as being uninhabitable, safety and hazard. So boarded up, something like that. So it's got a condemnation notice on it. But every neighborhood knows about houses that are just empty. People that have aged out, there was no market to potentially sell it anywhere, and so that house is just sitting empty, and possibly the children that live in Florida are maintaining the property, but nobody's living in it. And an unoccupied house is almost as bad as a vacant and abandoned house, right? You don't have eyes on the street. You don't have people in the house. So in 2011, we also started tracking the no mail indicator. So how many homes in your neighborhood is not receiving mail? So Howard Park saw the data and said, this is exactly our experience. We might not have the boarded up housing, but there's nobody living in these houses. And this is what we've been trying to tell the city for a long time. And the disparity between the no mail and the vacant and abandoned housing was just the right impetus for them to kind of walk with the city of Baltimore. And they canvassed the neighborhood with them to actually designate and put the notice on certain homes as vacant and abandoned housing. And in 2012, that they came up to a 4.1% vacant and abandoned housing. So now they're in that range of the 4 to 6% vacant and abandoned housing that the city's actually trying to be more proactive with. With the 2%, they're not trying to be proactive. But now they can be more proactive and make sure that if it is truly an unoccupied house that is unoccupiable, we do something as a city with respect to code enforcement in that neighborhood. So hopefully you can see like the way that this becomes very actionable on the ground and how a community organization can use what seems like an innocuous number and use it to its own advantage. So who else uses the data besides the community members? We actually give back data to the city. We have been repositing data now for 14 years from the city of Baltimore. And since I was the research division director at the planning department, I know all too well that the city does not reposit its own data. It writes over its own data. It's got live data. It's got real-time live data. It does not have very good historical data. And for better or worse, I knew that from the inside. So the city uses the BINA project as a constituent services. Any community that actually needs longitudinal data about their neighborhood, they come to the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance. And we've been actually able to give back data to the city. We gave them back 14 years worth of block integrated tax assessment data, which they didn't have. Or they didn't have in a way that they could access that quickly, let's put it that way. They probably had it somewhere in some mainframe that nobody knew how to access. So that's one of the values that we're providing back to the city. Obviously, foundations use this data. The Annie Casey Foundation is located in Baltimore and one of our biggest supporters in the city of Baltimore. But we have the Community Foundation in Baltimore that supports this work and uses the data for its potential grantees. Anytime they're doing a neighborhood-based grantee workshop, they will instruct the grantees to look at the data. And that's how we've actually created the indicators. We took a look. We have what's called a common area grant-making form. And so all of the foundations that are part of this umbrella organization use a common form. And so we took a look at that form and made sure that we had those indicators for all the neighborhoods to at least apply to say what the problem was in their neighborhood. All of our data is open. Again, if you were actually on our website right now, you can download that. You could start making an app right now if you wanted. And we've got the tech community engaged in our work. And what's fascinating is that our mission is distressed communities and community organizations. And yet everybody else kind of comes along, right? Because the data is useful in so many interdisciplinary contexts. So that's kind of been the bonus for us to learn from. There's four of us at the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance. There's only so much we could do. We learn every day from civic hackers that are using our site. We had one last year at National Civic Day of Hacking, which was last June. We had a code developer who was interested in this idea of vacant and abandoned properties take data from Open Baltimore, which is the city's open data portal, and our data and mash them together. And he has a site called BaltimoreVacants.org. And last year, it won the Sunlight Prize for transparency. So you can click, if you go to that website, BaltimoreVacants.org, you can click on any vacant and abandoned housing and then see the neighborhood context. You can see all of the indicators associated with that. And then this year, for the hackathon that went on this year for National Civic Day of Hacking, he added to it where you could compare neighborhoods next to each other, not just the neighborhood that you're looking at. So it's really fantastic. And we would never even think to do it. And this is exactly the type of engagement from the tech community that we're interested in having. And I think he actually went and bought a vacant house based on his own website, and he's developing it. So it's really, truly fantastic story. Every real estate developer tells me, not only the developer, but the agents tell me that they use this data. This is essentially market data for every neighborhood. We obviously don't call it that. We don't market it that way, but everybody seems to use it that way. The City of Baltimore Vacants to Value Program, part of it is marketing the vacant housing. And a lot of times you just get a call from somebody saying that they're using the data this way. There isn't any formal way. There's sometimes a formal way that we get these information, but most of the time it's a call. And I got a call from the marketing manager from Vacants to Value saying, we use your data to show that if you buy this vacant and abandoned property, there's actually all this other activity going on, and we send them to your website. Also good news. Faculty and students. So many different disciplines use this data in ways, again, that I would have never thought of. The most kind of maybe most interesting was data-driven journalism. The Journalism School at the University of Maryland uses this in their curriculum to do data-driven journalism with their students. So we get these wonderful stories about neighborhoods using the data. With respect to elected officials, I hope they use the data. I am maybe more jaded today than I was 4 years ago about whether or not they're using the data. But we try. We try as much as possible to brief them. I won't say that we have a terribly data-driven City Council in particular, but we will do everything we can to try and get our elected officials to use the data when they're making their own decisions. So that is hopefully a pretty clear overview of, you know, the breadth of how we use these indicators to look at those trends, to look at the context that these neighborhoods are in, and then actually drill down into neighborhoods. We have over 100 indicators, and each one of them tells a story about what's going on. We tell people, even though you think it's just quantitative information, it is very much human information. Somebody in your neighborhood had to do something to be even in that data set, and I can tell you exactly how. And that's what we do when we go into communities. And the other thing when we go into communities, when they say, we don't like that number, we don't believe you, I said, you don't have to believe me, but somebody somewhere is making a decision about your neighborhood using that data, whether it's a Census Bureau where we're talking about funding, or if we're talking about the city and doing code enforcement, they're using this information on behalf of, or possibly not even with, your neighborhood. So you have to at least know the data, know it. And then if we want to change it, let's change it together and see what comes out the next year. So I'm happy to take questions. Is that on time? I didn't get like a 5-minute warning.
I'm just
going to
go like that.
So let me make sure. Can you hear me through this? Okay, so we'll use this for questions as I'm going around the room. Feel free to hand me your cards. Does anybody not fill out a card? Show of hands.
Let's go for questions now. Bob's got the microphone.
Yeah.
Questions about Baltimore. Whenever there's something about Baltimore, I have to say there's so many parallels to Pittsburgh. And one of the reasons why we've been thinking about some of these joint efforts is we always have this parallel world. So I think today, for our group, you've really brought out a lot of things that are contrasts and differences, but a lot of things that have really probably touched people and some of the things they're doing about their own communities. Sarah? Get your hand up and Bob will get you. Sarah, did you?
We've got a lot of different neighborhood groups that are in a single neighborhood, and they're ostensibly getting the same data and getting the same message from you. Now, do you have the capacity within your four-person staff or somewhere else in the city to help those neighborhoods understand the data and to work together so that they're forming, you know, these collective impact agendas together and trying to identify what those things are that they can actually try to change?
Great question. Absolutely. We are called an alliance for a reason, because our focus is on making sure that the data is accurate and high quality. And I'm sure we can have a whole conversation about data quality. And most of my staff spends most of their time on making sure the data is high quality and integrated and retrievable that way. And that takes a lot of time. And I will say that that's the vast majority of the way our time is spent, making sure we acquire the data. I could have a whole conversation about data acquisition. In the world of open data, our job has actually gotten harder. I don't know if that's true here in Baltimore, but people tell us to go to Open Baltimore, but that wasn't the data that we used to get. We used to get more data than was up on Open Baltimore. So what I tell people is that Open Baltimore means less data for more people instead of what we used to get. But so we spend most of our time in data acquisition, integration, analysis, and then we disseminate it. So we put it up on the web. Our web is the way that we really do engage with people. And then we occasionally go to community organization meetings, and then we bring people into Baltimore day to day. That's just a drop in the bucket in the type of engagement that we could be doing. And so we have a steering committee. It's about 25 members strong. We specifically have foundations that are placed based on our committee, because when they're in their committees, in their communities, they can use the data because they know it so well. We have the Citizens Housing and Planning Association, which is really kind of an umbrella citizen engagement organization that we work with very closely. And then we do have a community development network that works with all the CDCs in the city. So the heavy lift with respect to communities that I find in the work that we're doing is convening people at the right moment to kind of use the data in an actionable way. That convening, I leave to other people. And when the agenda is set, we come. We can come. That's easy for us. But you know what it's like to organize communities. So we work with the typical types of organizations in the city of Baltimore that are already organizing communities to build community and come in when they need us to come in. So I would say that our community engagement strategy has that kind of an approach. We can do some things directly, but the vast majority of it, we rely on our alliance to tell us when to come and give a presentation at the right time.
This table has had two questions.
It's trying to make it democratic.
One thing, could you identify yourself beforehand for the group so they know? Question?
Sure. Alexis Macklin from Behind the History Center. I just asked you, who is funding your work?
The Vital Signs Project is predominantly funded by the Anna E. Casey Foundation, and that is about a third of our funding. Another third of the funding comes from people that need data. So we end up being a data partner. We don't necessarily have subject matter expertise in the type of work they're doing, and I can give you more information about that. And then another third is just research that we're doing on the data and working with communities on specific evaluations of neighborhood strategies. We're working on the Byrne Criminal Justice Grant in the city of Baltimore. The Byrne Criminal Justice Grant is kind of part of the federal government's way of integrating agencies. Byrne Criminal Justice is putting together DOJ, DOJ, HUD, and another organization. It's like sustainable communities. And what was fascinating about that one in particular is that, you know, we can come into those types of projects because we already have longitudinal data. We were able to tell that community that the Byrne Criminal Justice Grant was coming in for of how crime had moved in their neighborhood over time, because we had 12 years of longitudinal data and integrated data, right? We had crime, we had 311, we had vacant and abandoned housing, we had 911 calls for service from the police department. So we identified hotspots, and then we identified how they went through time. And the community got very excited about looking at this data, right? It's not only visual, because it's mapped, but again, it tells a story of what's going on in your neighborhood. You called 311, and that's why we have the data. And they wanted us to make sure that everybody had access to this information. So we went to, they had organized, this is a pretty distressed community. We had gone to a basketball game, the Basketball League of Youth, that had been organized there as a way to build community and have recreational opportunities for youth that are there. And we went to a basketball game and showed them the data on crime in their neighborhood over the last 12 years. And that was the most fascinating conversation I've ever had, because they got it. They got it. We could show them using the data that narcotics calls had actually been coming down in the neighborhood, but burglaries was way up than it was, you know, 12 years ago. And they told me exactly why. That yes, of course, we don't sit around, you know, putting needles in each other anymore. That's what we used to do in the 2000s. Now we have prescription drugs, and so if you want, you need to go rob somebody to get it. So, you know, whether or not we like the answer to that, I thought it was fascinating that they told me exactly what was going on in the data that I didn't have an explanation for. So I will say people are hungry for this information, and that's what we try and look for funding to do. Build digital capacity, build data capacity in communities. But just to plug maybe for a funding project like ours, it is not easy, right? It is not easy because the value of the data only increases over time. And so if you want to experience the value of your money today, you got to wait a little bit of time to see those trends. And now we can reap those benefits of people that invested 12 years ago. So fund your local indicator community project. And you did not pay me to say that.
No, we didn't do that at all. All right, so just to keep score, we've got table 4 with 2 questions. 1 is actually halfway there.
Absolutely. I'll ask 2 questions. Back.
I'm going to take on the second one. Some of us work outside of the city of Pittsburgh. I represent Steel Valley Council of Governments, and our municipalities are in the Mon Valley. And one of the challenges, we've been working on a lot of issues, and one of the challenges in the suburban communities don't have a central 311 or a central data repository. And I mean, the work that you're doing is wonderful. I'm curious whether or not it stops at the city boundaries and whether or not you guys have tried to tackle the suburban region, which is really important and interrelated to the urban core.
Excellent question, and absolutely. The world does not end at that line, which unfortunately many Baltimore elected officials think that it does. But our work should absolutely not stop like this. And so the last 2 years we have been engaging in the conversation. The region has a sustainable communities initiative going on right now, which is a HUD-funded project. And because of that, we actually are producing mostly housing-related information for all of the surrounding counties from Baltimore City. And that's been our first foray into the county. We would love to do Baltimore County. I don't know, again, if you're familiar with the city of Baltimore, Baltimore County rings us, but we are technically not a part of Baltimore County. And I think lots of Baltimore County people really don't think that the city is a part of the county. Let me tell you about our experience with that. One is, it's actually a little bit tougher in Baltimore to get a foundation to really support that kind of work. There is no real foundation out in Baltimore County, even though our data can show you that the lines are certainly bleeding about where distress is. So one thing is that we haven't had that central foundational support for this kind of work outside. The Sustainable Communities grant opportunity has been that way for us to get outside the city. We've told everybody in our strategic plan that we want to do Baltimore County at least, if not all the surrounding counties, which there are six of them. Baltimore County neighborhoods want this information. Absolutely. We've gotten calls from, since we're with the Baltimore Community Foundation, they themselves are working on a planning grant in just east, on the east side of Baltimore City. And they have told their grantees to come to us looking for data. And I said, well, we have some of the data, which we've shared, but we don't have all of it. The key is to get crime data and ideally education data. If we could get crime data, if we could work with that jurisdiction's police department, that would be very powerful for neighborhoods to get. So one is no centralized foundation that could pay for it or spearhead it. We don't need them to pay for the whole thing. This is about making that collective impact, that it's many people paying for some small part of it. Two is that clearly we want to do it and communities want us to do it. And then the third one is that there is less, and this might not be true here in Allegheny County, but there's a less desire to be transparent in the county level. I think that the Baltimore County itself, in fact, one of the agency heads actually told me in a room that we have no desire to be transparent because they don't want to show variation. If you show that variation, you can see the weaknesses in your county, and most elected officials in the counties don't want to reveal those weaknesses, because if you look at the aggregate, these counties look fine. But these data, you know, for better or worse, help us show Baltimore's strengths and Baltimore's weaknesses. And most counties don't want us to show that. So those are the barriers that we've had so far, but we definitely know that people want us to do this in the county, and we're trying.
I just want to say, before we get to our next question, I just want to say thank you, Seema. Can I shake your hand?
Was that for the funding the local community?
I'm not supposed to.
Questions over here?
And then also to say that many of our NNIP partners are very regional. Boston is regional, Atlanta is regional. We would love to do that kind of regional work.
And we have a very apropos question as a follow-up here. County Councilman.
Thank you, Bob. One of the things that we've been working on and dreaming about is having a beltway around the city of Richmond.
Don't do it.
All right. One of the things that you said was that one of the reasons you believe that the west side of Baltimore is like it is because of a beltway. Now, I don't know if I can concur with that, because one of the things, if you look at our parkways, all of them, we call them parkways, because there's a lot of parking being done on them. But the thing of it is that if you look at the traffic that's going on on our four lanes, coming through the city of Pittsburgh, there's a lot of truck traffic that comes through. That has to come through because there is no other way they can get the turnpike. We've started the Mon Valley connector, move freight from the airport, moving over to 22 and finding a 70, 79 center so they don't have to come through the city of Pittsburgh and jam up the roads. I mean, this is something to think about.
Yep.
When we're talking about that. I've been on the Baltimore Beltways and they're very nice. And they're very fast. But the thing of it is that without that, we're constantly in a problem, especially as we build up areas outside the city, like the airport corridor. This is one of the, I represent that area. We have a traffic jam both ways.
Right. So let me say quickly that if you talk to a historic preservationist, they won't say that the buildings are what they're trying to preserve. It's the street network that they're trying to preserve. Because the street network tells you how your city grew. And in the city of Baltimore, it happens to be that the city grew around that central port area. And then we have kind of a very radial street system. And because of that radial street system, that beltway that came around it effectively made some of those spokes irrelevant. And that's our network. That's our street grid system. The Pittsburgh street grid system may be perfectly fine for, or maybe not. But I would say, think about what the way Pittsburgh grew and what that beltway will do. So I will make no value judgments about beltways, because obviously for Washington D.C. it works okay too. But the point is that a neighborhood has to deal with these forces that seem far away, and yet they impact them. They absolutely impact them. And so if you are going to build a beltway, recognize that your street network is your arteries and the bloodlines for some of these neighborhoods. And if you take away some of that blood, you're going to deoxygenate neighborhoods. And that's what's happening to these West Side neighborhoods. They're not bad if you drove through them. They look fine, but they are slowly getting deoxygenated from nobody having to drive through them anymore. So that's what's happening, and we can show you in the data that that's what's going on.
Well, we have time for one more question as this portion of the question and answer wraps up. However, if you have any questions, you can definitely turn them into a table talk against me. Question, we have one more.
Data acquisition and data access. And I want to see if you could maybe touch upon, you might discuss it before about the collection of data from the organization that's not transparent, or data that's not easily accessible, you are able to get access to it.
So every single one of your city or county agencies collects some kind of data. Some of that data is better or worse. The best data is, of course, your permit data, code violation data. Those are things that the city has to track really well. They're not tracking it for us, but we can access it really well because that's the record. That's the official record. I think we've tapped into most of the kind of administrative databases in the city that we know about. More and more data is coming online as electronic, and we're trying to get those. So for example, we got a request to look at how many event permits a neighborhood calls every year, because that's a sign of community capacity building, right? People are partying in your neighborhood, that's a good sign. But the event permit data was in a bunch of binders. It was a form that people filled out and they were sitting on a binder and they said, here it is. And I said, I don't want it that way. But in 2012, they started making it electronic, and then I can grab it. And in fact, it's a GIS shapefile, so even better. So those are the types of things that we try and grab. But the holy grail for the types of data that we're looking for that really get to the issue of community engagement, that's a tough indicator, and community vitality, those are tough indicators, is we're doing one with the court. Did you say you're from the court system? Yeah, the court data is tough. We have a web scraper looking at foreclosure filings because that's the only way we get the data. I don't know if you guys are doing web scraping. But the other one is that we try to collect where there is no administrative record. we have to try and figure out a proxy for that. So community managed open spaces, so community gardens. There's no Department of Community Gardens. There is no official record of how many community gardens we have, because it's by nature a community grassroots thing. So it's four or five different nonprofit organizations that happen to be working with communities to create and fund community managed open space. And so we took all five of their databases that were not meant to talk to each other from a technical point of view, and then created an integrated way for them to talk to each other. And now we have a map that took kind of the union of all of them, because there was so much overlap on what records they had. And they were kind of fascinated to know that amongst all five of them, there were some 2,000 records that ended up being 900 when you deduped them. And now they're on the map that they can see. So I would say we administrative records, as they become electronic, is our kind of where we were headed. Trying to get court data is a huge effort because it's textual data that does not come in some type of a nice package. And then finally, trying to bring together many organizations that effectively have one unique indicator and have them talk to each other using data.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.